Greetings, errants, glitches, breakaways, thought criminals, and genuinely open-minded and outright curious inhabitants of whatever simulacrum we find ourselves navigating at the moment. You are about to set sail on another free first-hour episode of The Melt. If you find yourself wanting to dig deeper and have the desire to join the conversation during our monthly Melt meetups, you might want to consider becoming a monthly subscriber. For a measly 5 dead presidents per month, you can have access to full-length, early, and exclusive episodes. Just click the Patreon or Locals link in the episode notes below to create the timeline that will set it all in motion. It's suspiciously simple, altogether painless, and just might inspire feelings of bliss and or lingering euphoria. So, without further ado, let the conversations begin!
Hello, my name is Chris Snipes, and you are listening to The Melt. Hello, all you beautiful people. I just wanted to remind you that I am available for podcast production work for other podcasts. So if you like how The Melt sounds and you are looking for help in tightening up your podcast or audio production, I encourage you to reach out to me at themeltpodcast@protonmail.com. Today's returning guest, Mark Gober, is here to chat with me about his excellent latest book, An End to Upside Down Medicine, which again proves to be one of those well-researched books on a subject that many straight-laced, non-questioning folk might tend to dismiss as a conspiratorial flight of fancy. But, true to his style, Mark provides the receipts so much so that they just might sway the most skeptical among us. Something he has done in his books that I really respect is that no matter what subject he happens to be writing about, he makes sure to place it within a context that makes room for the idea that we are more than our bodies and that there is a vast amount of reality that cannot be perceived by our rudimentary senses. This is important within a cultural mindset that seems to want to reduce us and our existence to random meaninglessness. This is another episode where I am without Hunter as she was approaching the end of her last semester of school before graduating. Also, this episode was recorded a couple of months ago as I had overbooked a ton of interviews and then decided to relax the episode release schedule somewhat to increase my sanity. And so we have a bit of a backlog of episodes that are waiting in the queue to be edited and released. In mid-August, I will have an opportunity to attend to some of those, which I will be releasing as I finish them, and then hopefully by September we will be caught up and back on track to releasing episodes shortly after the interviews are conducted. In the meantime, I start off this conversation by asking Mark what the impetus was for writing this particular book.
Well, when we last spoke, this book was not on my radar. I'm pretty sure I didn't have a new book idea. I had heard people talk about whether viruses exist starting in early 2020. And it was sort of like the far end of the health freedom movement. There were some people who were saying COVID's not as bad as they're saying, and it's all about a vaccine agenda to control people's lives and control people's bodies. But then there were some people who said that SARS-CoV-2 is actually not even real, that that's never been found. So yeah. I'd heard about this concept. And I'd also, on the metaphysical side, since I started my, if you want to call it awakening journey in 2016, I was very much aware of alternative health and spontaneous healings and energy work. But it wasn't until around June of 2023, I spoke at a conference outside of Nashville, Tennessee called Rebels for a Cause, hosted by Courtney Turner, who hosts the Courtney Turner podcast. This was her first conference, I believe. And it was all sorts of topics, some political. My topic was somewhat political, but mostly metaphysical consciousness. And Alex Zeck was there, who hosts the Way Forward podcast. And he's been speaking about the topic of viruses, but also health freedom in general. I had met him online. I did an interview with Courtney and him on the topic of voluntarism a few months before. So cool. We had connected remotely. And when he was at the conference, I was supposed to speak right after he was. So I was backstage and he was talking about virology and how viruses haven't been isolated. So I missed the first half of his talk because I couldn't really see it and I was preparing to go on. But then they changed the schedule. So for the last half, I was going to be speaking later. I just listened to his talk. And I said he had some interesting points. He was mainly talking about logical fallacies and things that just appealed to me philosophically. And he invited me to be part of his in his series called The End of COVID. It's still available at theendofcovid.com. I would recommend it to everybody. But I was a participant in three of the sessions not related to medicine. I was talking about voluntarism, the Great Reset, global agendas as it pertains to medicine, but I wasn't talking about the science of what makes people sick, for example, or whether viruses are real. But as a participant, I was aware that it would, the whole thing was released. And a few people had said, actually, I think the first one was my friend, Dr. Edith Ubuntu Chan, who said, hey, you should listen to this interview. And it wasn't even about viruses. I think it was more about just like the philosophy of authoritarianism. But that got me to log in. And I had free access. Well, I think everyone had free access initially. Now you have to pay for it. And as a speaker, I think I had free access. So I just started listening to the other ones. And people were, it was doctors talking about virology and alternative ways of looking at health and what actually causes disease. And some of the things I heard, I was like, is this real? If this is real, this is a huge deal. I've never heard people talk about it this way. And this is how it always starts with me. I just kept listening to more and more, and I was trying to disprove what they were saying. Like, what am I missing here? And then the further I went down the rabbit hole, the more I realized that there was validity to what they were saying conceptually, and the topics were important enough that they needed to be presented so that people could make up their own minds. Because a lot of this is not determined. I would say it's inconclusive. There's a lack of evidence in many cases, and that's significant too. And also the positions, especially around whether or not viruses exist or whether germs more broadly cause disease, because the people who say viruses don't exist, they say, well, there are bacteria, but they just don't cause disease on healthy tissue. Those positions, I think, need to be presented in an authentic way. And often they're straw-manned or they're not even presented accurately, and people just make arguments to dismiss them without actually knowing about what the arguments are. So I said, why don't I put this all together, both the conventional medical stuff, including vaccines, which I had been wanting to talk about more in my other books, but I didn't have an opportunity. And then also add consciousness in, because the broader question as I zoomed out was, what are the determinants of health and disease? If someone has symptoms of something, what is leading to those symptoms specifically? What's causing a biological reaction where people actually have things where they don't feel well or they have lesions on their skin? And I think we culturally and also medically tend to have assumptions about why all those things are happening. And some of them are scientifically based, but a lot of it is animations in our head where we picture things happening.
Yeah.
And we come up with reasons. Dr. Tom Cowan calls it inventive reasoning. We just invent stuff to explain phenomena, but often they're not backed by science as well as we'd like to believe. And this is huge stuff because health applies to everyone. We all want to feel good. And if we're not feeling well, then we can be controlled more easily, which is very important in the context of authoritarianism, important in the context of a spiritual war, and also in the context of an individual's spiritual evolution, to think about what do symptoms actually mean? Is what can we do internally as part of our soul growth? So all of those factors together led me to say, I need to write this. But I will say, I mean, each of the books, in some ways, I've written them kicking and screaming, saying, I'm going to try this, but I'm not sure if this is something I can actually write or publish. I was strongly in that camp as I was researching this because this question of viruses, or some call it the no virus position, it's so contentious.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like if you say maybe there's no virus, you could be shunned. And I'm like, can I really do something like that? So I wanted, to me, there was enough there that I felt like it was a responsibility to put it out, not knowing the answer. I say that in the book. I don't know the answers to any of this stuff conclusively, but there's a lot we should be looking at and a lot the medical community should be looking at. Because I've talked to doctors who were like, oh, I didn't know that the HIV antibody test shows up positive for these 60 things rather than just HIV. Or there's lots of things that are taken for granted because doctors are really busy. They're not virologists. They're not microbiologists often. So they take in information from others and assume certain things. They have presuppositions and then work from those, and often haven't had the time, or maybe even in some cases it's risky for them to question the presuppositions. I wanted to lay it out so that people could then make up their own minds, and then hopefully we can move collectively toward better health.
Yeah, exactly. It does a good job, as does the book that we were just discussing before I press record, the Robert F. Kennedy book, The Real Anthony Fauci. Both of those really shed light on how much guessing actually there is in medicine. Like, it's so general in the way that allopathic medicine treats people, because it's like, okay, you have this cluster of symptoms. This is very similar to somebody else's cluster of symptoms. So we're just going to push you into the category of this disease, diabetes, or, you know, and because that's as close as we can get. And then we're just going to treat the symptoms of what we think that you have. And I don't know, we'll see if it works. And then if it doesn't work, then they just keep tweaking the pharmaceuticals that they give you and the dosages and the way that they work together until they get something that hopefully relieves your symptoms, but never cures you. It's never about curing.
Well, in order to cure, we need to know the root cause.
Exactly.
Why are the symptoms there? And often what allopathic medicine does is just put a Band-Aid on the situation, which in some cases you need to do in emergency. And there's definitely value to certain pharmaceuticals and certain processes. But that's not my interest. I'm not a clinician. I want to know, why do we get sick?
Mm-hmm.
If I have a symptom and don't feel well, what is going on in my body? There's a lot of complex stuff clearly happening.
Exactly, yes.
Why is that happening? So then it can be avoided in the future.
Yes, I agree. What were some of the compelling arguments that you came across when you were researching the book for the no virus way of looking at things?
Okay. Well, let me just clarify what the position says, as I understand it.
Okay.
There's no virus Bible, but like basically what those out there are saying, and some of the leading speakers. So I heard Dr. Andy Kaufman speak in early 2020. He was on the Brian Rose show. Brian Rose had a freedom platform where a lot of people were speaking for a while. So that was where I first heard it. Then I heard Dr. Thomas Cowan. More recently, Drs. Sam and Mark Bailey. They're based in New Zealand. There are others out there. And actually, before the book was published, Dr. Andy Kaufman and Mark Bailey were nice enough to read the book and provide comments, because I wanted to make sure I represented the positions accurately.
Sure.
And they gave great nuanced feedback, which is very helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
And I also, writing a book about medicine, I wanted to have some classically trained doctors look at it too. So that they're some of the major proponents, if your audience is interested in hearing doctors talk about this, and they have lots of content on all of their respective sites. But I think what tipped me was the work led by Christine Massey. And she has led a team and has done this herself, I believe, submitting freedom of information requests to government organizations all over the world. And with regard to SARS-CoV-2, over 200 institutions in 40 countries, including the CDC, where she asks very specifically, has this virus been isolated? Using the traditional definition of the term isolation, which means to separate from other things. This is a very important point, because in virology, when people talk about isolation, they're really referring to a complex method where the virus is identified through something indirect, which we'll talk about later, but it's not actually separating the virus from other cellular material, which is very important, because in a scientific study, you need an independent variable that you introduce into something to see its effect.
Yes.
But if you don't have something that's purified, then you don't know what else is in there. There could be other stuff that's not just this alleged virus. And if you don't have the virus by itself, how do you know that it even exists?
Sure.
So I quote Luc Montagnier in the book, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on HIV. And he says something to the effect of, well, you need to isolate or purify to know that it exists. That's why doing this is an important act. And I'll use another analogy from Dr. Thomas Cowan. He says, if you have a toolbox, you can take out the hammer, you take out the screwdriver, you take out the nails, and you can characterize each of those things and study them when they're in an isolated state. And that's what you need to do with a virus or any particle. And so with bacteria, which are larger than viruses are believed to be, there's no question about whether they're isolated because we can see them with a light microscope. It's an easier sell.
Sure.
You can see them moving around. Mm-hmm. With viruses, the history is very choppy. I mean, going back to the Greeks, virus, the term was eos, was a slimy poison. Going to the 1800s, Louis Pasteur, he was on his work on rabies. Certainly there are symptoms with animals and people who are bitten get sick, high fatality rate. The question is, why is it happening? And he couldn't see a filterable agent that was causing this, but he assumed something must be there. There must be this virus there. It wasn't until the 1930s that the electron microscope was invented, which is able to see things as small as viruses are believed to be. And I say believed to be because if we don't have a purified sample of just the virus, which we have admissions from of all these organizations all over the world through Christine Massey's work, if we don't have a truly purified sample, then what are they looking at under the microscope?
Yeah.
They're looking at potentially other stuff, mm-hmm. which is a big problem. And they might say, well, this is a viral morphology. It looks just like a virus. Look how the virus looks. And I would say, well, how do you know that? Well, because 30 years ago, they did the initial study and that's how it looks. Well, if they weren't working from a purified sample then, how do you know that's a virus?
Yeah.
The other problem is that electron microscope is showing you a static image. A virus is supposed to be a living thing that moves around. It is very specific. It's an intracellular parasite. It gets inside of a host cell. It replicates. It then goes out. It's causing symptoms in people. It can be transmitted from one person to the next. That's a specific definition. And if you're looking only at a static image rather than something moving, we've never seen a virus. All of the evidence is indirect. And there are many pieces of indirect evidence that people would say, well, then it must be this intracellular parasite. But there's no direct evidence of actually seeing that thing do all the things. It's just through inference. So I'll pause there because this is the foundational stuff. Once you understand these principles, I realize, then everything else flows from it. Someone will say, well, Mark, what about all the genetic testing, genomic sequencing? What are they doing the sequencing off of if they don't have a purified sample? What else is in there? What other genetic material are they picking up?
True.
And then how is the sequencing done? It's all done in a computer and it's very complex. Sometimes it's patching things together. Mm-hmm. Or people will say, well, look at all these. There were a lot of people in the same place. They all got sick at the same time with similar symptoms. It must have been a virus. They must have caught something. Well, how do you know that it's a virus? How do you know there wasn't a toxin or some common other issue that causes illness or EMFs or electricity or some other issue that's not necessarily a contagious thing? Or someone might say, well, look at the success of antiviral drugs. And the response could be, like Dr. Mark Bailey, when I was corresponding with him before the book, he's like, well, chemotherapy isn't really anti-cancer drug. It's more like an anti-metabolite. Same with antivirals.
Exactly.
You can have something that reduces symptoms for non-specific reasons.
Yes.
You haven't gotten to the root cause of it. So all these things that we call viral or an antibody test or an antigen, and we'd say, look, you tested positive for this virus. No, you tested positive for something that's believed to be associated with a virus, whether it's an antigen or antibody. But those things could be produced or they could come about on the test as a result of a stress response that's not viral. And the body consistently has that same response, and it's picking that up consistently, and we're just calling it a virus, even though we haven't isolated it in the first place.
Exactly.
So I'll pause there. Once you realize that principle that there is an isolation purely done, which seems to be admitted all over the place, then everything else is problematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like carbon dating. Like carbon dating, when I found out what it actually was, it's basically seeing what the age is of the rocks that were in the location of this thing that you're trying to date. It's like, well, that doesn't mean anything. It really, I mean, that's just inferring that the thing that it's next to is this has been around at the, you know, around the same time period as this thing is coming from. So it's like, there's a lot of wiggle room there. But before we go any further, where did the concept of a virus start? Like, where did this all begin?
My understanding is that people were trying to understand where symptoms were coming from. And this notion of something invisible, well, there must be something, the slimy poison, or there must be something at a microscopic or submicroscopic level that is causing illness. Now, the modern definition, I would say that became more prevalent in the 1950s.
Okay.
And this was one of the turning points for me in my understanding when I had the historical context of, well, they didn't understand why people were getting sick. They said it must be a virus, even though we can't see it. We don't have the equipment to be able to see it. But then in 1953, Watson and Crick's double helix structure of DNA paper came out. So all of a sudden we had genetics in a way we didn't have before, which is essential to the virus, the virus concept today, mm-hmm. and also the bacteriophage, which is a particle. Mainstream scientists would say it's a virus-like particle for bacteria. It's specific to bacteria. Now, people in the no virus camp would say, actually, no, that's not true. Yes, these particles are real, but they show up in response to, it's a stress response from the bacteria. And that shows up if you isolate bacteria in a certain way. So there's debate about that. But these particles are believed to exist. And in the 1969, the Nobel Prize, which you can access online, the very last sentence of the report, which just describes the Nobel Prize, says, well, the bacteriophage serves as the model for the modern day virus. So you have genetics plus the structure of the bacteriophage, which anyone can look up what they look like, plus the 1954 study by Enders and Peebles. This is really foundational in virology. It's the method that they would call isolation, even though in the paper, the authors said that there might be other factors that are non-viral, which might explain their results. And Enders won the Nobel Prize later that year in 1954. So he was this credible guy, but it became the paradigm. And the paradigm was this: you take fluids from a person who is sick with something that you believe is a virus, and then you put them in what's called a cell culture. It's a soup of material that has, depending on the study, antibiotics, monkey kidney cells, all sorts of stuff in this soup. You add the fluids of a sick person, which might be filtered partially, but never is it just the virus. You put it in the soup, and they see if the cells break down in the soup. And they say, well, if the cells break down, well, obviously, look, it must be a virus. It's called a cytopathic effect. They want to see if there's a cytopathic effect, whether the cells break down or not. And if there is, that would be an indication of a virus. Of course, someone with a critical mind would say, well, maybe there was something in the fluids from a sick person. If you didn't just isolate the virus, other stuff from that sick person that's causing something in the soup, or maybe stuff in the soup itself. You've got antibiotics and all this other stuff in there. Would cells break down if you didn't even add an alleged virus to it? And these are the control studies that many of the no virus people say need to be run. There have been some run. So Stefan Lanka, who was a classically trained virologist, ran some studies on this, and he put yeast RNA, for example, into the cell culture soup and had a cytopathic effect, a cell breakdown, didn't add a virus. And so there need to be more of these control studies, which would really debunk a lot of conclusions from old virology that need to be run. And I've been pointed to some of the other doctors I've talked to and I've heard about. They'll point to basically unintentional controls that were run in certain virology studies, where it's like in the paper that they got a cytopathic effect, cellular breakdown without a virus. But they're few and far between. This is what I mean earlier, where I say I don't know. Like, there's work that needs to be done and funded on this to actually see these results, but it's pretty significant that the controls aren't typically run in the studies. Those are the two main complaints of the no virus camp: a lack of an independent variable, meaning an isolated virus to see if it's actually causing disease, and number two, a lack of proper controls. And Dr. Kaufman made this point that I hadn't thought of. If you don't have an independent variable, you really can never have a proper control, because you don't know what you're even controlling against if you don't know what's in that thing.
Exactly.
But even in the absence of that, a typical control would be, well, let's see if there's a cellular breakdown in the soup without adding anything. Mm-hmm. Let's see if there's breakdown with yeast RNA. Let's see if there's breakdown with something else that's allegedly non-viral.
So why do you think these studies aren't happening? Because it would send tumbling the house of cards that allopathic medicine basically is? I mean, because basically the idea of a virus, and we've seen it the last 3 years, has been absolutely weaponized. I mean, that would really that would really poop in their cereal if they, that's the best metaphor I could come up with in my exhausted brain right now. that would send a lot of things into question.
Yes, this is a key point you raise here, because there's a debate in the, if you want to call it the health freedom movement. There are those who say vaccines are problematic. Everything with COVID was about authoritarian movements with governments to control. But there's a virus. Come on. And don't say there's no virus, because you're distracting from the broader point. They would even say this is a problem to go down this road.
Sure.
But the point you raised is really the core of this. And one of the reasons I felt like it was important to write the book to get more discussion around this If you believe there's a contagious virus that can be transmitted from person to person in an invisible manner, you have this invisible enemy, it can be a weapon to shut down the world. And if that's not true in the way we're told, we need to know that, because it also would affect our collective psychology in terms of the fear that's out there that probably contributes to illness on its own.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And you mentioned that in the book too, like different ways that what we think is an illness could be transferred. We could just be in a morphogenic, I always get those two words confused, field with somebody, and you empathetically sort of take on their symptoms because you are connected to this person in some way. And maybe there's something that's being transferred on an energetic level, but allopathic medicine would never even think to look in that direction because it's basically material reductionism in practice, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there could be, and there are studies on this that I reference in the book. Of course, we need more replications that suggest there's an energetic resonance between people. It would be a non-germ-based contagion. So one example, I mentioned telesomatic events, which I had talked about in my earlier books. But these are instances where you have, say, identical twins that are far apart from each other in terms of where they're oriented spatially, like they're not near each other. One is injured, and the other one, who's far away, develops the same injury physically. And Dr. Larry Dossey, who's a medical doctor, he says this appears something like 30% of identical twins have reported things like this.
Wow.
And there's lots of other pieces of evidence which suggest that perhaps there's something that's an intangible contagion, and we're mistaking it for something physical. We're wanting to make it this dangerous genetic intracellular parasite when in fact it could be something else. Mm-hmm. And also, I get into this later in the book with this discussion of consciousness, the role of emotions. We don't think about that. What happens if people were exposed to a similar emotional shock and part of the bodily response is to actually have symptoms? There's so many possibilities that aren't typically considered because there is this germ-based paradigm. And it's very convenient for not only governments and authorities, but for the pharmaceutical industry or any medical industries that want to have a pill that can fight this enemy. It creates an us versus them fear-based mentality. Whereas the no virus perspective is part of something broader known as terrain theory. And terrain theory says that germs don't cause disease on healthy tissue. First of all, there's no virus that hasn't been shown to exist. But even like bacteria, they exist and they will show up in large quantities, but they aren't the pathogenic instigator per se. They will show up as a cleanup crew to help decompose dead and dying tissue where there's an underlying toxicity. So we'll say, look, this person's got a big infection. And if you ask someone, well, why is the infection there in the first place? That question isn't asked very often. Yes, there's an overgrowth of bacteria, but perhaps they're there because there's an underlying toxicity for some reason. And therefore, the bacteria are helpful in a way, even though they can emit endotoxins or other things when they exist in large quantities. The role of these microbes in the world, some would even say parasites have a similar role. They clean things up. Or fungi.
Sure.
They're cleaning things up with that they're nature's cleanup crew. So it creates a much less antagonistic view of the microbial world, which is interesting from a metaphysical perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah, it seems like mentality-wise too, terrain theory is of a different ilk altogether than the sort of the mentality of germ theory, where you're almost in the role of a victim, where it's like, I was just minding my own business and this germ came up or this virus or whatever and came up and just made me ill and kind of took me against my will and so on and so forth. Whereas terrain theory is about more about self-responsibility, where it's your job to have a healthy terrain so something doesn't go wrong with your physical body. So it's interesting because, I mean, I see allopathic medicine as being very passive in a way. There's not much nudging from the medical industry for people to take responsibility for their own health. It's more like, just sit and relax. You don't have to change your lifestyle. We'll just give you a pill and everything will be okay. But terrain theory, you have to work for it and you have to keep healthy in a more substantial way, I think.
I totally agree. The responsibility is on the individual. And certainly there can be authorities to help people help themselves.
Sure.
Yeah. But it's the terrain is your physical body, how it's doing, but also your emotional sense. So
for sure.
The word terrain comes from like if you're taking care of plants or you want the terrain to be doing well so that the plants will grow. And if so, the body, and I would say the body-mind complex is doing well, then the person will be healthy under terrain theory. There's this hybrid where people will say, well, I'm a terrain theorist, and I probably was here before I looked at the no virus stuff, where they'd say, sure, if you're eating well and you're in a good mental state, then you're going to be less susceptible to infection and you're not going to catch bugs as much. So it's this hybrid where there's germ theory with terrain theory overlaid on top of it. That's not what we're talking. We're talking about a pure terrain theory where germs do not cause disease versus germ theory is there are these microscopic pathogenic instigators and they're going to get you.
That's, I almost caught myself going there too. I was like, if your terrain's in good there, then something can't come from the outside. And yeah, it's a total retraining. I mean, I just listening to the book, and I will have to say that you're the no virus section of your book, which is a substantial portion of it, went into detail about all of that in a way that I hadn't heard before in a very extensive and clearly informative manner. I've heard it mentioned in podcasts and interviews and different books and stuff like that, but this really went into it in a way that I feel like I know a lot more about it now. Because there's a part of me that's still unconvinced, although there's many, many things about it that make sense. I have those questions like, how can somebody walk in a room with sniffles and then, or in a classroom, we'll say that. And then, you know, the next day, everybody's got the sniffles. Like, you know, just things like that. Like, how does that work? You know?
It's a conditioning. Yeah. That we see epidemiological data, which is patterns of illness. Mm-hmm. And we attribute a cause to it. Dr. Cowan calls it correlation thinking.
Yes.
We see a correlation and then we jump to a cause. And what this no virus movement is doing, what I try to express in the book is we can't just jump to causation. We have to think of all the possibilities, whereas most doctors and people in society culturally are going to jump to one conclusion without having the evidence that would be required for it. And therefore, the funding and the remedies are going based on the one causal conclusion rather than the other possibilities. So one of the counterarguments is, okay, you're saying it's not a virus. When people walk in the room and a bunch of them get the sniffles, mm-hmm. then you don't have a good alternative hypothesis.
Yes.
And we could list a million of them, toxicity, emotions, EMFs, electricity, poor nutrition, et cetera. But show me all the studies on that. And it is lacking, mm-hmm. but it's lacking for a reason because exactly. we're not looking into it. There's not as much of an incentive to study that and so forth.
Exactly. It's not even on the menu of allopathic medicine because as you've said, and we've stated here, it's very materialistic. Would you say that that's maybe allopathic medicine's greatest downfall, the fact that it doesn't take spirit or anything that you can't measure into the equation, or are there other aspects too?
Well, the more generalized way of stating that is that it's reductionistic.
Yes.
It likes to find a physical singular cause when it can, rather than looking at multiple factors and looking at the spiritual consciousness related elements. Because in mainstream academia, if you talk about spirituality or consciousness outside of the brain, life after death, psi phenomena, that's all bogus stuff to them.
Yes.
Whereas, as your audience is aware, there's a lot of scientific evidence for that. My first book, An End Upside Down Thinking, was as much evidence as I could find credibly mm-hmm. to suggest those things are real. Well, if you have a different metaphysics, then that would imply we have to change how we think about the body. So I'll give an example I mentioned in the book. The University of Virginia, their division of perceptual studies at the med school there, they've studied over 2,500 cases of young children who have memories of a life that is not their own. And in some cases, the researchers find historical data and documentation that validates the children. And then in some cases, they find medical records that align with birthmarks and deformities that the children have that they claim aligns with how they died in the previous life. So what Dr. Ian Stevenson said at UVA, child psychiatrist, he was like, you know, usually in medicine, we think that genetics and environment are the two factors that influence the physical form that we have and our health. And here we've got physical deformities and birthmarks that cannot be correlated to genetics and environment. There must be a third factor. I mean, that on its own is massive. There's a factor affecting health that modern medicine is completely missing.
Yep.
How can we possibly get things right without all the factors?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Do you think that there was ever a time when medicine was more aligned with the spiritual aspect of things?
I do wonder. I mean, there's the Flexner Report in the early 1900s, which basically changed the way medicine was done in the West, went from a more holistic approach, even things like homeopathy, toward the allopathic approach, which is not looking at the root cause quite as much, more pharmaceutical focused, yes. Not as holistic.
Yeah.
So there's been a shift. And it makes me wonder back, looking at ancient techniques like Ayurveda, these seem to be very mystical practices, ways of healing that had deep knowledge, but it's probably not appreciated in the way that it should be because of the reductionistic perspective on life. So I do think there's a lot of value in looking at these ancient cultures and seeing how they were healing people, and then combining it with the modern developments of allopathic medicine to use in emergency situations, or there are ways where it can be used to maybe phase out of the allopathic so people become more holistic. There's an integration that's likely needed.
Absolutely. I've had good experiences with traditional Chinese medicine, which is very much an example of medicine dealing with the individual on its own terms, whereas allopathic is more like, let's find the nearest group that we can categorize you in and then treat you like that. But like the practitioners that I've experienced, they take your five different pulses, and they could all be different depending on the variables and the combination. That could mean many different things. And they speak about it as like your liver is too hot or your liver is too cold. So what we need to do is do something else to heat this up and make sure that it's like, it's everything is a, it's all a part of a whole, as opposed to, well, you know, your liver's fucked up, so we're going to give you this pill that is going to relieve the symptoms of your liver being inflamed or whatever. And that doesn't do anything. Or that might offset something that's, you know, down the line that is affected and connected to the liver. But because allopathic medicine is so clueless about the connections of all these things, that it's just like throwing darts with a blindfold on, you know, like, And they're surprised when the dart actually hits the dartboard. Like, oh, okay, let's grasp onto that. We'll up your dosage or whatever. It's like, it's so bloody inept.
Well, the results speak for themselves.
Yeah, I mean,
look at the level of chronic illness, heart disease. Look at COVID even. If you believe that is a virus, did we do a really good job of helping people not have those symptoms? There's so many illnesses that continue to exist, which should tell us on its own that we have a long way to go.
Oh yeah, definitely. And reading the RFK book, it's interesting because Fauci was kind of doing the same thing with AIDS back in the 80s, like taking clusters of illnesses and putting them together and calling it something. And therefore, then we've sort of invented this condition. So now we can invent a pharmaceutical to treat you for it, a patentable pharmaceutical to treat you for this thing that we've just basically come up with out of thin air. And COVID was the same thing. COVID was the flu for all intents and purposes.
Yeah. I didn't understand until I started researching this topic more that this whole movement of no virus terrain preceded COVID.
Yeah.
And one of the strong points, just as a naive listener, to those who said, well, the no virus thing is a psyop, is that it just seemed to emerge out of thin air with regard to SARS-CoV-2.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't realize that's not true. I didn't understand the history. 1954 was Enders and Peebles. So it takes some time to have this model of an isolated virus, allegedly isolated with the Watson and Crick 1953 double helix. And the HIV-AIDS scare was in the early 1980s, not that long after.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize there was an organization called the Perth Group that was asking the same questions about no virus. And you could go to their website, theperthgroup.com. There's a very extensive technical paper called HIV, a virus like no other. And with regard to SARS-CoV-2, one of the seminal papers is called A Farewell to Virology by Dr. Mark Bailey. These are both available for free, highly technical papers, but there's just a lot of similarities in terms of asking questions fundamentally about the nature of these alleged viruses. How do we know for sure? I mean, Luc Montagnier even said about HIV, we did not purify. So there, these questions were coming up before. It was just maybe not as loud. And with COVID-19, the whole world was shut down. So they reemerged the arguments. And to me, as that makes the whole thing more credible than I had originally thought, that there's a history I can trace here. It didn't just pop up out of nowhere to try to distract people.
Yeah.
There's a line that I can draw.
Exactly. And it's interesting to see, I mean, we see this with history and the way that media and propaganda sort of tailor narratives to fit their agenda, but that we've definitely seen that in the case of the medical industrial complex. And it seems like the COVID situation has really shown how all of those tentacles are going back to the same metaphorical octopus. Like, they're all operating in tandem. There's a united agenda that I think is mainly motivated by financial gain, because there's so much money to be made. And Big Pharma basically runs politics. Big Pharma basically sponsors all media. So the narrative is so easily sculpted. I don't think people realize how it's so easy to put forth a narrative and have every media outlet basically saying the exact same thing, and if you're not a rooter around, if you're not digging and doing your own research, you don't realize how many things are censored. So it's like people don't realize how their menu has been tailored to only have a few things on it when there's so much more to offer.
And that goes for doctors themselves and even some researchers who just take for granted certain presuppositions and haven't looked into this, who might be willing to say, well, I'm just going to dismiss all this because that couldn't be true. I don't think this is a massive conspiracy in that every virologist is willingly concealing. I think they're going by the methodologies that they were taught. And they say, this is good enough. Well, viruses are really small. We can't fully isolate it. We can get it pretty purified. And then they'll say, well, the virus is an intracellular parasite, so it's in the host cell.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we couldn't get it. I mean, it had to get into the host cell, and it would probably leave that you could then theoretically isolate it. So they make these excuses, and then they base everything off of that. There must be some people that know this
at
some level.
Yeah.
But I don't know how all that works. So I do think it's a misconception, because people say, well, it must be a conspiracy among all these doctors and virologists.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't believe that's true.
Well, I think it's a mixture of ignorance, like you're talking about, along with people who are afraid to stand up and say something because they're either their jobs or are under threat, or they're just general shunning from their community, because there's so many. It's become religious in a lot of ways, with the way that people believe about medicine, or the way that the medical industry believes in medicine. Is like there's these certain statutes. And they've always been that way, or they've been that way for long enough that we don't need to question them anymore. And we'll just operate on them from them, like their assumptions. And that's not good. I mean, medicine, like science, like anything in life, needs to change and evolve and be flexible enough to be able to face criticism. And it's so strange that woman, Christine Massey, did all those FOIA things and nobody could come up with the evidence for any of it. None of them.
I need to get you an exact quote.
Okay, please do.
Because it's so, I mean, one second.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the sort of thing that where I said, I've got to write about this, because most people don't know what the CDC has admitted. Let's see. So the CDC, their response, this is November 2nd, 2020.
Mm-hmm.
The request asks for all records in the possession, custody, or control of the CDC describing the isolation of SARS-CoV-2 virus, and it was met with the following response. Quote, a search of our records failed to reveal any documents pertaining to your request. That was November 2020, so we were well into lockdowns at that point. You'd expect it would be easy to pull up records, and the reason they didn't is that the method of isolation in virology is not actual isolation using the traditional definition.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing and frightening. I mean, and Fauci, again, to bring him up, I mean, he was such a focal point for all of this. He was like the figurehead, the spokesperson for, well, I mean, if Fauci says it's, then you're either with Fauci or you're against him. And at one point, he even arrogantly stated, if you question me, you question science, which is, my God, that's like a cult. That's cult talking right there. It's it's so religious. Insane. What were you going to say, Mark?
No, yeah, it's a religious way of looking at things. Science becomes a religion, which in the field of consciousness, it's something I encountered, but in medicine, it's a very similar thing. It's this is the way it's done. And if you question it, you're not allowed to question.
Exactly. We've talked about the separation between church and state. What about church and medicine? Like, and what church are we talking about here? The lines are so blurry when you start looking into this stuff. And how much there is just hearsay. I mean, and I think many people look to doctors and the medical establishment like as faultless people, like as a faultless institution. But I mean, there's so many people that they're just operating on guesses, or they're operating on something that their higher ups told them.
Or something that was studied 100 years ago, and they assume that the foundational studies were done properly.
Exactly.
With regard to contagion, which is part of what I write about in the book, there's two parts to this with viruses. Mm-hmm. Number one, does a virus exist as an isolated thing? But a virus is supposed to cause disease, and it should be transmitted from person to person. It should be contagious, transmissible. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of questions about the transmissibility. Now, if you don't have an isolated virus, that's problematic because you don't then even know what would be transmitted.
Yeah.
But assuming you did, the way the transmission studies are done, I've just been shocked that it should be really easy to demonstrate some contagion. You've got a sick person, and there should be some healthy people. And if you put the sick person with the healthy people, they would get sick.
Exactly.
Or a lot of them would, or something.
Yes.
But you see the Spanish flu, there were studies done in 1919, for example, Milton Rosenau, medical doctor, where he was having people cough in each other's faces and no one was getting sick. They tried everything to transmit the Spanish flu. They were not able to do it. So some of the other studies that allege to show transmission, they're typically done in a very unnatural way, where in nature, you're around each other, there's something in the air, you touch something and it gets into you somehow, and that's how things are transmitted.
Sure.
But many of the transmission studies involve injecting unpurified samples, which we know they're unpurified and they haven't isolated the virus. So there's other stuff in there. And they're injecting it into animal brains, tracheas, all sorts of things. And in the book, I talk about these methodologies. And they say, well, look, some of the animals got sick and the symptoms, maybe they're not exactly like what you'd expect, but they're kind of similar. Yeah, that's a demonstration of transmission. And did they run controls? Did they inject water into the animal brains? Often they're not even running proper controls.
Yeah.
So these assumptions, it must be contagious. They must have proved this to be true. And what I'm finding, the people who have looked at this no virus stuff and even the doctors, they can't find the studies that are properly controlled where there's a proper independent variable using natural means to demonstrate contagion properly. That means that every illness that we would consider to be a contagious or infectious disease, perhaps there's another explanation. And that's what I look at in chapter 4 of the book. I take representative diseases like Spanish flu, rabies, chickenpox, polio, all these different things that are believed to be contagious things. What are the other possibilities without knowing for sure, given that we don't have proper isolation of the virus?
You use a term in the book, genetic determinism. What is that?
It's the idea that we're basically doomed based on whatever our genetics are.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be a certain way. Oh, that's a genetic issue. That's how it's going to be.
Gotcha.
Now, it might not always be that strict in modern medicine, but there is that kind of inclination that there's a genetic proclivity or tendency for something. And that might be true to an extent, but it, like you said before, kind of puts a person in a victim mentality.
Exactly.
I was born with these genetics. What can I do?
Yeah.
Versus, what can I do? This is my terrain, my physical and psycho-spiritual terrain. So
exactly.
I can do something about it.
Yeah. I find that really insidious when, I don't remember when this started happening, probably sometime in the 90s is when I noticed it, but the diagnosing of alcoholism or drug addiction as something that's genetic, like you're genetically set up to be addicted to alcohol, which I think is outrageously crazy. Like maybe you grew up around somebody that drank a lot. Maybe I can understand situationally being in an environment that might cause you or give you that idea to have that lifestyle, but something genetic that predisposes you to that seems crazy. And then it's called a disease. Like, is there some sort of germ or virus that's causing you to lift a beer can to your mouth? Like that's like saying, I have no control. This this disease of alcoholism has taken over my life. It just seems like it not owning up to your actions.
Well, this is another example, I would say, of correlation thinking. That you have people who have similar, there's heredity clearly among people in the same family.
Sure.
And they attribute it to the genetics. But what other common factors have those people encountered? Mm-hmm. Were there similar traumas that they experienced that led them then to say, well, I need to dull this out with drugs and alcohol, for example? So it's about looking at all the possibilities and saying, well, what can I do to fix this? And the psychological and issues and also the issues of trauma, I think, are often overlooked, when in fact, they might be the core. I mentioned in the book, German New Medicine, which has become a fascination of mine personally since writing the book. I only mention it briefly because a lot of the stuff, even like the telesomatic events and the consciousness, we have some pieces of data, but it's not like we have the strength that we would prefer. So these are, to me, they need to be developed more strongly. But German New Medicine was developed in the late 1970s by Dr. Hammer. And what he discovered was that when people have emotional conflict shocks, he could find lesions in the brain that would show up on CAT scans that corresponded with the emotional shock, which would then correspond to an organ that would then show symptoms.
Hmm.
So after seeing enough of these, without even looking at CAT scans, people can say, well, you've got those symptoms. You have a separation conflict that you're healing from. So the idea, this is generally how it works in German New Medicine. There's an emotional conflict shock. The body builds up its defenses to handle the conflict. And then there's a resolution of the conflict, at which point the body has to expel all the excess stuff.
That
is called the healing phase, is when the symptoms show up. So to them, the symptoms are part of the resolution of the conflict in many circumstances, which is an interesting way of looking at it. So then you can trace when your symptoms occurred, when did the emotional conflict shocks occur. But even more broadly, the idea is that we need to be paying attention to our emotions much more, because they might be the reason we're getting sick. And it's not this little invisible thing that hasn't been isolated. It's something that we're processing, and we have an ability to then handle on our own if we look at our own thoughts and beliefs.
Exactly. It's like, taking some sort of a Tylenol or something for a fever reducer. Like, let's get rid of your fever. Like, no, you want your fever. Your fever is burning off the thing that's your sickness or whatever your infection is or whatever, you know, like that's a good thing. That's a symptom. That's, as you said, that the symptom is the resolution of whatever is happening in your body.
It's some would call it a detoxification process or a process of getting back to equilibrium.
Exactly.
Where the body has to expel it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard different opinions on this in German New Medicine, because they would say that once you've had the conflict shock and you've absorbed the conflict in a certain way because of your own psychology, the symptoms are going to come. And sometimes you can use suppressants, they would say, to help you get through that phase. So I think there's some ideological questions depending on the practitioner. But generally, I agree with what you're saying, that like the symptom is a critical part of allowing the body to fully detoxify on its own time, because the body's own wisdom. So in traditional medicine, we vilify the symptom. Whereas in this conversation, we might say it's part of the body's intelligence to actually help you heal.
Absolutely.
Point you to something that you should be looking at.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Something is painful because it's trying to draw your attention to it. Like, either this needs fixing and you need to do something about it, or change your diet, or put some sort of an ointment, or take an herb or whatever, or this is letting you know that some sort of reparations are happening. Yeah. You don't want to deaden that stuff.
And I wonder, on a spiritual level, I kind of theorize in the book, speculate, are the symptoms a way of telling us something about our soul's evolution?
Yeah.
That we're sick because we're having some kind of emotional problem or problem in the way we're living, which is coming from our consciousness, and therefore it's leading us in environments that are problematic. And those symptoms are a warning sign, like, hey, you need to wake up. You're not waking up on your own. Therefore, we're going to make this painful for you. And it's your choice whether you're going to evolve and do what's needed to alleviate the pain, or maybe you're going to end up with a chronic illness and maybe you're going to die because you haven't learned your lesson.
Exactly. Yeah, the way that Chinese medicine deals with that, or the way that they view sickness, is that, you know, your energy, your chi, life force, whatever you want to say, naturally moves through your body in a particular way and through particular channels or meridians. And it's only when that process gets blocked somehow is when you experience sickness. So the idea is to free up that blockage so that the energy can flow freely again, which makes total sense. If you're looking at an interconnected system, and, well, let's say a system of highways, for instance, and, you know, a big tree falls down in one of the main intersections of the highway, then the cars aren't going to be able to get through. So you need to get the tree up to so that the cars can get through again. But I really like that way of looking at the body, because it shows you that, you know, even though you may have a pain in your shoulder, maybe the blockage is actually occurring somewhere else in your body and it's just deferring to that point. So rubbing some Bengay or something on your shoulder to, or taking some pain medication or something to relieve that, is totally missing the point.
Right.
Yeah.
And we could even go deeper and say, well, maybe there's symptoms are emerging because of something ancestral or related to past lives that has to be cleared.
For
and
sure.
Actually, as I was researching and thinking about these same concepts, I developed a new opinion on the soul trap concept, because that's been coming up a lot. Like, is our, I don't know the answer. I don't think we can know. Is reincarnation a trap where basically dark beings are feeding off of our energy while we live, and we get trapped after our soul goes into the light after we die, and then we're recycled? That's the theory, which is really interesting. I don't know how we'd validate it either one way or the other. But if it's true that symptoms are part of helping us point out where we could do better, it seems like an evolutionary process where, yes, it is painful, but if you identify the points of the root cause of that pain, then you can be in a happier, healthier state. That seems to be an engine of intelligence driving toward evolution.
Exactly.
And you so could, this, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say really quickly, you could even take that situation in one of two ways. You could, I'm sure there are more ways than that, but you could go, oh my God, boo-hoo, why am I experiencing this pain, God? And just feel like you're a victim of your circumstances. Or you can see it as a, okay, I need to tweak something, or I need to up my game a little bit, or I just need to rest or something, like, and deal with it head on and as a challenge almost, as opposed to something that's just another thing in life that's against you, and, you know, taking it very seriously and feeling like it's happening to you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which to me points to the more traditional spiritual notion of that we're in an evolutionary playground, and pain and suffering, while unpleasant at the highest level, do result in some kind of evolution. Mm-hmm. I think studying healing leads me more in that direction, which is where I started, although there's some interesting arguments on the other side. And maybe, I don't know, maybe it's not uniform, where there is a trap for some souls and for others it's not.
Yeah.
But even the trap, I know we're getting a little off topic, but this is central to all
it's
of
all connected.
Spirituality.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, I'm just fascinated by it, because it's one way or the other is going to cause you to have a very different view of the world.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And I feel unsettled on this. I'm like, where am I? Even if you believe in the soul trap, there is an implication that there's something outside of the trap that is benevolent. And if you believe that, then this nefarious trap must exist within a broader benevolent context. So even in the event of a trap, to me, that's an evolutionary playground on its own.
Sure.
To see through the deception.
Mark, thank you so much for taking the time to once again sit down and chat. And it's been fantastic. I highly suggest anybody who's listening to this who's not familiar with Mark's books to check them out. The audiobooks are also very enjoyable because it's read by the author, as it well should be. Because the author, you know, he knows where to emphasize what words and how to say them because he wrote them. So yes, both of them I highly recommend. And I'm sure that we will have you on again. Maybe we can have you on again around the time that this episode comes out for another Melt meetup.
Okay. I love that.
Okay.
I enjoyed the last one.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me, and give my best to Hunter, please.
I will do that. She will look up from her homework. I will definitely do that. But yes, I'll make sure she's here the next time we chat. So
right.
All right, Mark. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for making it this far. If you've liked what you've heard and are thus inspired to contribute to the well-being of the Melt, there are a few easy ways to do that. The most tangible being financially, which can be achieved by clicking the Locals or Patreon link in the episode notes, and then you will be led through the process of starting your monthly subscription for a mere $5 a month. This will give you access to exclusive episodes, full-length episodes, and you can participate in our monthly Melt meetups, where we can congregate together as a community and often get a chance to chat with some of our guests more intimately. Another way to help out would be to go to wherever it is that you listen to The Melt and leave a favorable review or rating. You can also spread the word via sharing or recommendation to friends and family, either in person or virtually. And lastly, if none of those options are readily available or appealing to you, simply send your positive thoughts and intentions. In an interconnected and quantumly entangled multiverse, these also go a long way. Thank you.